tried to go through over the course of the semester a number of business topics that are dealt with in halakhic literature. And as you're familiar, there's quite a bit. Exposed to a certain extent to where a lot of the literature comes from. So we could easily spend a long time, much more than the time that we had, going through these topics. So we're going to have to a little bit of trial and error, see how much we can cover, see how fast we want to go, how much detail we want to go into, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I'm sorry if we still buy or not figure out what we do if I have it 151. Tell you what I sketched out in terms of what I hope to cover. I don't think that it will cover everything on the list. I think it's probably a little bit ambitious. So again, we'll experiment a little bit with how fast to go, how much to include, and there'll be a little bit of trial and error. So I would like input after I tell you what I have in mind. If you have any topic that you thought should be on the list that wasn't there, please let me know. And anything that you think should be especially prioritized, especially if we're not likely to finish everything, so please call that to my attention as well. Those of you who are either in the ethical and legal class, either right now or have been in the past, there is some overlap. I originally wanted to work it out that this would be completely separate from that course with no overlap. Didn't seem to make sense because we'd have to exclude too many major topics. But there is some overlap. It's not an incredible amount of overlap, but there is a little bit. One major difference between that course and this course is that course, there's no prerequisite Torah knowledge, and we try to make sure everything is equally accessible regardless of your background. Here, we are going to be on a little bit more of an advanced pace, and I am assuming a certain amount of facility and familiarity with the Hebrew terms and halakhic literature and the way it works. Not to say we won't be translating anything, but it's not the same level as the other class where it's expected that everything is going to be understandable regardless of the background. Here, there is a little bit of a working assumption that there's a certain familiarity with halakhic discussion and literature and the like. If there's any questions, you know, again, don't hesitate to ask them, but it definitely will be functioning at a more advanced and a quicker pace and a more detailed pace than that class, if that's relevant to anybody here. And one major difference is also that that class is a secular class with a secular textbook. This is from that class. This class is not really a secular class. It's part of what's such a chiddush that they're, I think for the first time in a while, having a class of this nature that really is more Torah-oriented in the afternoon. Along those lines, by the way, is there anybody interested in staying for Meir right afterwards? We have a minion of people who would stay for Meir. Okay, we'll see if we... Okay, but I think, you know, that'll be the only 6:10 Meir, so I have enough people who want to stay around. That might be appreciated, but that's a religious comment. So in any event, one thing I should also mention before going over the topics is that while this is a new thing in recent years, it's not the first time ever. And it's very important to point out that back in the years when I was a college student here, there was a class that was taught by Mori Verabi, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And it's very important that we give proper recognition to the work and the life ideals of Rabbi Levine, who was the head of the economics department here for many, many years, and who was a very fine Talmud Chacham, a very fine person in all ways. And he really was a pioneer and one of the major, major experts on halacha and business and economics and the like, and really forged his own path in terms of this discipline and really was a Torah Mada personality in a way that's hard to match. There are many different conceptions of what Torah Mada means, but as somebody who really
set out a path. We often throw around easily the terminology, the best of Torah, the best of Mada, etc., as if they so often coexist. But Rabbi Levine was somebody who was really a Talmud Chacham of the First Order, and who was a economic scholar of the First Order, and who brought that expertise to many years of service in Yeshiva University, and who passed away too young about 2 years ago on Pesach. And we will make reference to his books are available. I have them here if you want to see what I'm talking about. We'll definitely make reference to his writings, the author of Economics and Jewish Law, and the author of Free Enterprise in Jewish Law, and more recently, right before he passed away, he edited the Oxford Handbook of Judaism and Economics, something along those lines. Very fine, important works, Moral Issues in the Marketplace, other such books are all very worthwhile reading, so occasionally we'll make reference to them. Maybe we'll have the opportunity to make copies and give out some readings of various essays. So it's very important, before we start this course, that we should give due recognition to the legacy of Rabbi Levine, and to recognize the fact that, again, for all of us who are younger, this may seem like it's a very new thing, but a while ago there were courses. His course was called Comparative Economic Systems. It was a time when, I guess, it was a little more subtle in the title about what he was addressing, but there is a very distinguished legacy behind that in Yeshiva University. So with due recognition to that, so again, the topics that we'll try to talk about, so we have 13 weeks, is that correct? So I tried to make up a list of 13 topics, and even doing that, and with some artificial combination, artificially forcing some topics together, I still came up with 16. So even if we succeed in keeping it to one class a topic, we're still not going to finish everything. So we'll have to, again, play it by ear and see how fast we go. Again, if there's anything that you feel is not on the list, or anything that is on the list that you think is too far down, should be pushed up, should be emphasized a little more strongly, something that you very much want to hear about, please don't hold back. But the topics that I have on this list, which I guess I'll email out to you, the first topic for today was slated an introduction. Talk about various overarching themes in this discipline. The next topic I have slated for next week is the topic of Onah and Mekavtos, essentially deception in prices, price fraud, differences in prices and values and sales. That's one of the major overarching topics in monetary law. Affects a lot of business dealings, and if you're learning Bav Metzia, it's the topic of the fourth chapter of Bav Metzia. So that's the first thing I have on the agenda after this introduction today. The next is Gnevas Das and various types of deception, which are included within that heading. That's a very major theme. The fourth topic, very, very practical for people who are going into business, but certainly practical people going into business, but also it comes up in everybody's life at least once or twice, is the concept of the prohibition of ribis, of interest, and the concept of heter iska, which is a way of dealing with ribis. So that's also, if you're learning Bav Metzia, that's the whole fifth chapter of Bav Metzia. So that's a topic by itself we could spend a year on, but we should spend at least one class talking about that. That comes up certainly if you're in business, but also just if you're buying a house, if you're buying a car, if you're going to a store, it comes up all the time. So we should talk about that. The fifth topic I have list here is corporations/partnerships. So how the halachic status of what a corporation is, whether a corporation is a concept that's recognized halachically, that's a whole topic that's subject of extensive literature, and also what a partnership is, and what are the laws regulating the responsibility of partners to each other, and how do they operate? They operate as people or as a new entity. It's similar to corporations, which has a lot of impact in a lot of areas of Jewish law, and so that's down here as the fifth theme. Number six, contracts and agreements and negotiations, everything in that category. Number seven, again, these are a little bit artificially grouped together, but I wrote here monopolies, competition, and Hasagas Gvul. It's also in the category of competition, all those issues. Number eight, issues of consumer protection, price controls and the like, anything that's there in the interest of protecting the customer. Nine is about advertising. 10 is about labor issues such as salaries, downsizing, severance, labor rights, unions, etc. 11 is bankruptcy. 12 is a topic I specifically put here for the fall semester. Thought maybe you might find it interesting. You could tell me if you disagree, but the topic of Mechiras Chametz, which has obviously relevance as we approach Pesach, which we will be by that point, but also it impacts on a lot of business concepts, so I thought maybe that was worth a day. 13 is intellectual property and privacy and all the issues that are under that heading. 14th wrote here recession issues and also investment advisors. That's again an artificial connection, but trying to keep the topics manageable. 15 was the topic of Dina de Malchusa Dina, taxes, governmental laws, etc. And then the last thing, 16th, which put last, not because it's lowest priority, but it's kind of a end of the course kind of subject, is practical issues, such as issues in other areas of halacha that come up in the workplace, including dispute resolution, Bezdin, etc., and Shabbos issues, Kashrus issues, different various other areas of halacha issues that could come up in a business context. So essentially that's what I have written down on the syllabus. Any comments about that? Any surprises? Anything that different from what anybody expected? Anybody like to see something there that's not there? Anything that anybody like to see moved up higher on the list? Yosef?
False marketing.
Yeah, well, that's in the Gnevis Das category. Well, those are pretty early on because that ties into both Ona and Gnevis Das. Those are like the first two things after today.
You're talking about later on.
Advertising?
Yeah.
Right, advertising overlaps with that. So maybe we could bring that in earlier also, but a lot of false advertising is in Ona and Gnevis Das. And you are Block. You are Yonatan Block. Yes.
The end of Mokusadina. Are we
yes.
going to get to that?
God willing, we should, yeah. So that's also is also kind of a catch-all topic, which is why I put it by the end, but we could move it up earlier also. Okay.
Can you just lightly explain what you mean by Mechira Chametz?
It's not so not simple. You could easily talk about that the entire semester, too. It's actually very, very fascinating. But, it's relevant just because Jewish people who observe Pesach tend to interact with it, and it's very complicated both practically and philosophically, and it happens to draw on a lot of business concepts because it's a business transaction. So it's not strictly speaking any more necessary for somebody going into business than anybody else, unless you happen to own a bakery or a supermarket or a brewery or something like that, or stocks. Actually, it really draws in a lot of business issues. So if it wasn't for the fact that you will have to observe Pesach, you'd be less interested in it, but it happens to have a strong draw on a lot of the business ideals. So, experiment. Brett?
Just based on what you just mentioned, and in the end, practical issues, you mentioned Shabbos, having a business that's
open,
like an internet business.
Right, so that's definitely very much in that category. Right, so again, so that topic, the practical issues, the fact it's mentioned at the end is not mean that it could potentially be pushed off. It's just kind of a catch-all kind of thing at the end. We may decide at the end that it's worth having two sessions for the practical issues. Yeah, it's definitely worthwhile also identifying some practical issues that you think are particularly relevant to make sure that they get on the list. But yeah, that's definitely one of them, internet businesses that are open on Shabbos. And that's an issue that existed before the internet. Other businesses that are open on Shabbos being run by partners, being run by the vending machine literature, all kinds of was relevant even before the internet, but certainly in the era of the internet, it's definitely a relevant issue, and it's certainly included in that heading. Anybody else have any observations? Any points? Hi.
When you said stocks, it was interesting. Could we maybe look at how it ties in? If you have partial ownership, and maybe you own, like you're saying, stocks.
Mm-hmm.
You own a company that somehow translates to guns, alcohol, cigarettes.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a lot of what stocks. I have that as a separate heading. I think that's under corporations. Right? Yeah, that's going to be part of the corporation issue. I don't know if I specifically said that. It's a huge topic. Like I said, we'll have to see how much we can squeeze in. But stocks, a lot of it has to do with, first of all, what does a corporation mean? You know, do we recognize the existence of a corporation as separate from a group of individuals? Three Jewish people get together and form a corporation. Do they cease to, is that a Jewish corporation? Is that not a person? Is that a group of people? Is that a partnership? It has tremendous implications for some of the technical categories, such as loaning and borrowing with interest, owning chametz on Pesach, having stock in McDonald's and the like, but also some of the broader moral issues in terms of what businesses do. That's definitely something that's important. We'll try to make sure we can get to that also. Hi.
Two issues. One I mentioned in the last class as well, which is maybe like disclosing information, especially when we're at Flesh and Hara and the spots.
Yeah, that's also, I wonder, is that included in anything that we have so far?
And you obviously can't include everything.
Right. So the truth is, we could make Lashon Hara a separate session. It comes up for a lot of things also. Lashon Hara in terms of your coworkers and in terms of your competitors.
Right.
Yeah, so the advertising. Maybe we could include that in advertising. I did have in mind to include that somewhere. All right, but you're right. But there's enough topics within Lashon Hara that impact on business that it probably deserves its own separate heading. So,
and
okay.
The other one is Shabbos playing it. You know, if you have a store that's open,
right?
You know, online
storefronts. Right, so that's what Brett brought up, so that's definitely included in the Shabbos category. Okay. Anything else? All right, so with that... sorry.
Are we going to be tested on this?
Oh, yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So that's another thing that I wasn't sure about. So let me take a quick poll. So I didn't put this in the syllabus yet, and I asked Dr. Pavi, he didn't have strong feelings. Take a quick poll. So this is a 2-credit course opposed to a 3-credit course. So I wasn't sure if there are different requirements or different expectations. So the question is whether we should have a midterm or not. There are pluses and minuses to having a midterm. The minuses are obvious. It means taking a midterm, which is never fun. But it'll take a class out of our schedule. The pluses are that it gives us a chance to review a little bit more seriously some of the stuff, but also it helps for the final. In terms of your grades, you probably do better having a midterm beforehand because I usually give cumulative finals, so the questions that are on the midterm can turn up on the final again, so it's kind of a dry run. And if you do well, you can practice and average it out. So for your overall grading experience, you may find that it helps to have a midterm. Brett, a question about that?
If you don't have a midterm, is our grade going to be 100% final?
It would seem like it would be 100%, not 100%, but it would also involve attendance and class participation. Now, class participation means that active and helpful class participation can boost your grade, and disappearing can hurt the grade. And being present and not being so involved probably would have a neutral. But if you're very involved, that definitely helps a lot. If you're involved in a productive way, which in my experience, everyone who's been involved in a practical way, in a productive way, so then that would definitely help a lot. And if somebody disappears, that would definitely hurt. Yeah, but like I said, you know, it would even out. If a person's just present, it doesn't do anything, they wouldn't feel it at all. But if a person disappeared, they'd find a major impact on the grade. And if somebody was very involved, that would definitely significantly boost things. Chesky?
Is it at all possible for us to have a sort of research paper?
It is. Right.
That's
definitely open to that. How would you... Sometimes people feel that's a bigger burden. Because if you're at the count... Right.
Well, you wouldn't lose a class. That's the benefit. So
right.
Lose a class.
So
you also do a take-home.
Right. That's also true. Is there an interest in doing a research paper?
Personally.
Truth is, yeah. Yeah, you could probably pick a business ethics topic and write a decently serious paper about it. See, the problem is it's hard to do it for some people, not for everyone. You know, if there's a general consensus that that's an effective way to do things, then happy to do that. But if only some people, I can't give a midterm for half the people, and
But either way, there would be a final. That would be a
yeah, the final, I think, is a general requirement for everything. Everyone's got to have a final. So the test, if you want to talk about this now, I guess, you know, might as well, is that, okay, what I generally like doing is kind of short answer essays. However, kind of speak that basically, not into the whole multiple choice thing, it's kind of, well, it definitely would be easier for me from a marking perspective. It would save me many, many hours of my life. It would make a lot of things a lot happier. But it's just not so reflective. And I'm not into pigeonholing people until you have to know this specific fact or else you're nothing. So essays kind of give you more room to express different kind of things and what you know about something and a little bit more, a little bit less, and gives more potential to evaluate people in a more broad and objective way. So that's what we've usually gone for. Okay, so not really so decided on the midterm. So maybe by next class I'll have a decision on whether they'll be high. I have no idea. If it can be, if it's legitimate, then we could do that. That would be better.
I just take home class, take home midterm, take home final.
Take home final, I'm sure I cannot do.
Professor Gilani,
yeah,
the last semester.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's the dean. Yeah, he's the dean. All right, I'll ask him. Okay, so
don't
if he,
that.
All right, if he allows it, then then we'll talk to him about it. Okay. So by next class, we'll have some decision about that. Okay, so with that in mind, so let's talk a little bit about some introductory themes. And just to get a little bit of a sense of what the concept of Jewish business ethics means and the place that it has, the whole realm of interpersonal law, of Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, how it plays out in the halachic sphere. We know that we do have a tremendous emphasis on our business values, on integrity within business, that the general theme of honesty, the Talmud tells us, the Gemara says, the Chosamo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emesu, that God is represented by truth, and that we are meant to be people of truth. And particularly in the context of business, that the Talmud says that we are told that the first question they're going to ask us when we go up to Shamayim, when we're judged on our activities, the first question is a number of questions that we're going to be quizzed on, but the first one is Nasasa v'Nasasa b'Yamuna. Did you deal with others faithfully? Did you deal with others honestly? And we believe in a higher truth about property and about how things should line up. So the Gemara says, for example, Gemara in the beginning of Sanhedrin, that if somebody is in a dispute with someone else and they go to a Bezdin, they go to a court and they lose and the Bezdin rules against them, so they should be happy. Why should they be happy? Because apparently, let's say they lost their coat, the Gemara gives the example that somebody takes them to Bezdin and the Bezdin decides that you have to give them your coat. So you should be happy because apparently the coat was not legitimately yours, was theft in your hands, and now that's been rectified, you no longer have stolen property on your hands, so that's a good thing. That's something you should celebrate. And we believe there is this objective truth, so to speak, about property and about integrity and about the possessions that we have, and we'd be much happier to have everything done honestly and to only have what we deserve, so to speak, what we legitimately have, and to not have anything that belongs to anyone else in our property, in our possession. Hi.
So that assumes that the Gemara is saying that human judgment is flawless, right?
Not that it's flawless, which is an interesting question also. So, you know, what happens theoretically, Bezdin can make a mistake. But let's assume, at least for the purposes of that statement, that the Bezdin was correct.
Okay.
But it does open up a question. So is there an objective truth to a Bezdin decision? Do we say that what they say is got a certain objective truth to it, regardless of what the history may be? So that's a worthwhile discussion to have. But even before we get to that, let's just assume that the Bezdin is accurate and correct. So you're much happier to have the truth told to you and to have the property back to its rightful owner You'd rather have that than have something that doesn't belong to you and have something that's not your property. And it's fascinating. The Gemara in Chulin has a statement which seems to be the opposite of anything we would say. It seems to go in the opposite direction. That the Torah tells us about Yaakov, that Yaakov, before he had his interaction with the Malach, before he had his wrestling match, so the Torah tells us he went back, and he left himself alone and vulnerable. And why did he go back? Because he left some small jugs, he left some pachim ketanim. And that's a very striking thing, that he should expose himself to danger and go back alone for property, for small pieces of property. And the Gemara says that you see that tzaddikim, part of the nature of being a righteous person, is chavivin aleihem amonim yosu migufam, that they care about their property as much or even more than their lives, willing to risk their lives in order to protect their property, which very much runs counter to what you might think. You would think, all right, the nature of being a tzaddik is that you're not materialistic, is that you don't focus so much on property. And the Gemara addresses it a little bit by saying, explains it a little bit by saying that this is true because shlopash yudeim begezel, that the nature of a tzaddik is that he hasn't engaged in theft, that whatever he has been honestly earned, has been acquired legitimately, and therefore it's a testimony to his honesty. But even so, that wouldn't fully explain it. So the later commentaries explain that we also believe that God gives us property for a reason, that God allows us to have what we have because it's something that we can be productive with, it's something that we can maximize our potential with, and therefore we don't take a casual attitude towards our property. We want to have only that which is legitimately ours, but that which is ours, we want to value and make sure we can maximize. I think Yosef was up first, then Alexander.
I was just thinking that scenario. Maybe you can suggest that the reason why righteous people would do such a thing, to put themselves at risk for the property they earn, is because any vessels represent how these people spent their time, meaning time is more than money, and so therefore this vessel, from what I've earned as a result of my investing of time as part of my life, it has super significance because it's a representation of something much more than just financial means. How I spend my time in my life to now create something that I can use in the future.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that too. None of the explanations are fully going to explain the language of the Gemara where it says even more than their lives, because that's clearly, that's still going to be difficult anyway to interpret it, but I think there's definitely truth to that as well. Alexander?
Just to help understand the second opinion, wouldn't one say naturally or logically that if God is putting, God gave me, God gave me X and Y, and then God's putting me in a situation where, if in order for me to get X and Y, I have to risk my life, which is, as you said, counterintuitive. Wouldn't that be a scenario? Maybe God's taking it away from me.
So that's even more similar to the case with the Beis Din, where they took away your
coat.
Right. So that's it's hard to explain the second part of the way the Gemara phrased it. Is always going to seem a little extreme to say that more than your life. It's hard to explain that with any of the interpretations, but. Well, I think the thrust of the Gemara is that if it's possible for you to hold on to your property and to not casually let it get destroyed, let it get lost, so there is a desire to do that, because the same way, it's the flip side of the equation, the same way you don't want to steal, you also value what you have. You recognize that what you have is there, what you have legitimately and honestly is there for you to make use of. And similar to what Yosef is saying, just like your life itself is there for you to maximize, so too what you have is a resource. Some of the commentaries point out that if Yaakov had gone back, if the Torah had said that Yaakov went back for a safer Torah, that wouldn't strike us as so unusual. It sounds unusual because he went back for pachim ketanim, for these small utensils. That seems trivial. But if he had gone back for a safer Torah, so that wouldn't strike us. People go into burning buildings and take out safer Torah. That doesn't surprise us so much. So it doesn't surprise us because we perceive that as something holy and something that needs to be valued and esteemed. So the point here seems to be that the tzaddikim see everything they have in that sense, that anything that's been given to them is something that they can use towards maximizing their potential, and therefore they're very careful about it. This is something that they're going to go to a great extent to not be casual about, to not take it legitimately, but also not to waste either. And it's also interesting, the author of the Tanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, has this, an attitude in general which is felt as a little bit too harsh. But in this context, it has more to be said for it. That we know that in halacha, so we have mitzvos and we have obligations, and we have core beliefs, we have principles of emunah. And we usually treat the principles of emunah as more severe, as a bigger deal than the specific mitzvos. And you could violate an avera, you could do something wrong, it's not the same as heresy, it's not the same as kfira. But Balatanya has an attitude that you could say that any transgression anyone does is, in a sense, heretical, because you're basically saying that God's not watching. But if I believe God was watching me all the time, so I wouldn't be able to sin. So if you could engage in any sin, so you're essentially saying that you deny the presence of God. So you could question that attitude, because it's a little bit overly harsh, because not everything that somebody does is because they deny their consequences. So, for example, you know, if somebody eats unhealthy food, so he's not saying that he denies the fact that it's going to have a negative impact on his body. He's just saying that he recognizes that right now his desire for the food is stronger than his focus on the consequences. So I don't know if you have to go that far. I'll take the comments in a second. But I think in the context of theft, it has much more impact, because if a person eats non-kosher food, he's not necessarily denying that God is watching. Okay, his desire for the non-kosher food is so compelling that that overwhelms his focus on anything else. But when it comes to theft, if you really believe that God is running the world and is going to decide people are going to have what they need, and what's yours is coming to you, what's coming to you is yours, so then there isn't anything to gain from theft. Ultimately, it's all going to be corrected anyway. So you don't really have a desire to steal if you don't believe it's going to benefit you. And therefore, in this area specifically, there's an even greater awareness of the fact that your belief is intimately connected with your desire to deal honestly. Your name was again, I'm sorry. Yes, Abraham.
Just the Baal Tamid said that, isn't it? Isn't it talk about that?
What says that any other is kfira? Yeah, that's something different. The Rosh means that you're doing something foolish.
Right,
you know, but to say that it means that you deny God exists.
Right, so I think
that's what Rosh means?
He says it has to be the Rosh Hashdos, otherwise the kfira.
Okay, but that's still a little softer way of saying that the Ruach Shtos allows you to not focus on the implications,
right,
which really shows you why it's not kfir. You know, it's more the sense that it's possible to sin even though you believe, because you're able to be distracted by whatever instinct has come in. But when it comes to theft, so the temptation, if one really is aware of how it correlates, so the temptation, if one really believes that God is running the world in this area, so then you have a much stronger focus on only having what you have legitimately. So that's a major element of how we relate to what we have in terms of our monetary rights, and that's a theme that runs through everything. Hi.
Why are we focusing so much on theft, and as opposed to, like, we're saying non-kosher? Like, theft is sort of, I would think theft you associate with very spur of the moment. If you're in a store and a kid just steals something, he's overwhelmed. But, like, kosher, the food, you go to the restaurant, stand in line, wait for the food, you have more time to think about it. Why are we focusing so much on that?
I don't know if that's necessarily an absolute distinction. I think both of them you could make examples in
either
category.
Okay, this could be over many years.
Yeah, I think in both cases they could go in both directions. I don't know if that's really...
You're just saying as an example theft, or we're saying specifically?
Yeah, and I'm just saying that specifically, the idea of how you focus on your monetary possessions, that that there does have that connection to it. So we have this very strong focus on our moral integrity and on our monetary honesty. And in general, it's also important to realize that this is true for objective reasons. It's true also because it's especially important. We find emphasis many times throughout the Torah and the Talmud that it's crucial that we be perceived this way by the nations of the world, recognized as people who are honest and who are upstanding. And even when we're not, even if that doesn't follow through. And you're probably familiar with the comment that Rashi has the very beginning of the Torah, the first Rashi in Chumash, Rashi asks why it is the Torah starts off with a story of creation.
To give that answer.
Right, that the answer that Rashi gives is that the Torah starts with a story of creation because that will be a response, apparently, that when the nations of the world say, oh, the Jews stole the land of Israel, it's not theirs, so then the response will be, no, God created the world, he can give the world any part of it to whoever he wants, so he gives it to, he decides to give it to the Jews, that's legitimate. So you might think, okay, so then that's the solution to peace in the Middle East. We'll just pull out the first Rashi and Chumash, and he could just tell Netanyahu next time he has a meeting, he could just pull out his Chumash and show the Rashi to Abbas, to Obama, to whoever it is. He'll show the Rashi that'll take care of everything. So why does that not work? Okay, because they're not going to believe the Rashi and Chumash any more than they're going to believe anything else. So then what's the point? Right, why do we have the statement there if it's not going to really do the job? So many have commented that there's a very important message there, that this is not a response to the nations of the world, this is to ourselves, that we have to know that we have an ethical and moral system, and even if it's not perceived that way, even if the nations of the world are not going to agree, they're not going to sign on to it, so that's unfortunate, and we are very interested in being perceived that way, we do want very much to be recognized as a ethical, moral, and honest nation. But even when that's not possible, it's still of tremendous importance that we recognize that ourselves. That we recognize that that is the core of our existence, that we have a system of integrity and honesty, and that that's how we operate. So that's important for ourselves, important for us to know. So working within that, so we have monetary obligations, and we have obligations towards each other. We have a whole half of the Seres HaDibros, a whole major part of the Torah, that we are directed in our behavior ben adam l'chaveiro, and how we treat each other. And it's the focus of a lot of the Torah, right? The focus of not just half the Ten Commandments, but many of the mitzvahs of the Torah command us to treat each other honestly and to treat each other respectfully and with dignity. And it's a topic of a lot of discussion why that is, because society does regulate these things to a certain extent, especially nowadays. We live in a democratic just society which will regulate monetary law. So why don't we rely on that? Why is that not enough? And there is much discussion about that. Some suggest that it has to do with the need for objectivity, that even if we believe that people can come up with moral values on their own, but everyone has their own take on everything, and even issues such as life and death, murder and the like, are subject to a lot of dispute as to what constitutes murder. You could have debates about abortion and debates about euthanasia, the beginning of life, the end of life, when does life begin. There's very little that's truly objective. There's very little that everybody will automatically agree on. Even if you think we can all agree that murder is wrong and theft is wrong, what constitutes murder, what constitutes theft, is not something that the world agrees on. So we need to have an objective system, and we also need to have a committed system. We need to have something that is not just we think it's a good idea, but something that we believe goes to the core of our responsibility on earth, and that we are going to cling to even when it's not convenient, even when it's not desirable, even when it's particularly challenging. If this is a core moral religious idea, then presumably our commitment is going to be much more profound and much more solid than it was simply something that we think up on our own.
What's the question exactly? Why we need a Torah?
No, why does the Torah have to involve itself so much in the details of interpersonal relationships? Let society will have to come up with something. Society regulates these things and has laws. So why don't we allow society to deal with it? Correct, but that's how that's the case. You know, why that's the case is something that requires a little more understanding. And on top of all this, it's that we believe that the Torah brings sanctity and brings Kedusha to everything that we do. And therefore, that Kedusha is not limited. It's not something that we just see in Shul or we just see in the Beis Medrash. we just see in the very overtly religious context, but it's something that we see in all of our business dealings. And you may have heard the story that somebody once came to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was famous for focusing our direction and our attention on ethical study and Musar, and the man was a shochet, that was his job to shecht. And there's a lot to know in the laws of Shechita, and there's a lot you can do wrong, and you could end up making a lot of mistakes. So the man told Rabbi Yisrael Salanter that he thinks he wants to quit Shechita and go into business. It's just too nerve-wracking, that he has to know so much Jewish law, he has to know all the halachas, and he has to get everything right. And it's very hard to be a shochet, he wants to quit and go into business. So Rabbi Yisrael said, what are you, crazy? That's so much harder. And if you're worried about making a mistake, you're worried about not knowing enough to be able to do your job properly. So there's so much more you have to know to be able to deal honestly in business, to be able to not violate any of the many, many Torah prohibitions that come up. It's much more than is involved with an aveil. It's much more than is involved with shechting an animal improperly. So if you think that you'll take the easy way out, you're going to business and you won't have responsibilities to know halacha and to worry about not making a mistake, it's quite the opposite. This is an area where we have a lot to say, and we're getting it right and getting it imbued in our consciousness is a very big deal. Hi.
maybe why isn't the question, why does the Torah give us the question? I'm saying the Torah gets involved in our lives, like our, even like so much your emotions. Maybe we should be happy with people. This you should love. But maybe why isn't the question, why does the Torah give us you know, these boundaries for society, halachic laws? Maybe it should give us the work on yourself as a person, and from there we'll evolve and create the laws that say this is who he owes him if he breaks. You know, his shore damages his shore. We'll evolve to say, obviously, from this logic that'll be created.
Okay, so that's actually an important point that you're addressing. Let me address that for a second. So it actually gets to the next point that Joseph is asking, that shouldn't this therefore be an area which is more value-driven than detail-driven, that let's study the values and work out the details on our own. And the truth is, there is a certain amount of weight to that, that this is an area where studying the halacha has a different kind of impact on you than other areas of halacha. And it has to do with the fact that we do have more access to the values than we do otherwise. And to give you another Rabbi Yisrael Salanter story, that Chafetz Chaim supposedly said the following, that the Chafetz Chaim, you're all familiar with, wrote the classic Sefer on the Laws of Lashon Hara, which I guess we'll go to class talking about. And he was once approached by a businessman who wanted to buy all of his many Sfarim, with one glaring exception. He didn't want to buy the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. So Chafetz Chaim is a little offended. It's his most famous work. It's what he's named after. So he asked the man, how come you don't want to buy the Chafetz Chaim? So the man said, listen, you wrote a lot of Sfarim, and most of them are not going to cause me too many problems. I can buy the Mishnah Berurah, tell me how to daven, how to keep Shabbos. All right, I'll be able to be okay with that. You wrote about the Korbanos. It's not going to cause me so many problems nowadays. You wrote about not speaking badly about other people. So I'm out there in the dog-eat-dog world of business. I don't think I have much of a chance of being able to keep any of these halachas. So if you don't mind, I'll buy everything else except that book. So not so surprisingly, the Chafetz Chaim didn't buy that argument. And he told the guy he thinks that he should buy the book anyway. And to make his point, he quoted the aforementioned Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He said that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had said about the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, said, it's such a wonderful Sefer. This Sefer is worth it, even if the only thing you accomplish is that one Jew reads it, and, what's the next part of the sentence? You think, and changes the behavior, that would be worth it. That's not what he said. It's worth it, even if all that happens is one Jew reads it and sighs. Meaning what? He says, if only I could keep all of these halachas. Well, I can't, so moving on. That would be worth it. That's hard to understand, because that's really a non-halachic principle. He's essentially saying that it'd be worthwhile if people would read the Sefer, learn all the laws, and even not follow them, it would still be worthwhile. That contradicts halachic principles. Is that what you want to say? Correct, right? We normally have a rule that mutav shushogin v'al yumezidim, which means that if you know somebody's going to violate the halacha, so better off they should know about it. If they hopefully will observe the halacha, so then okay, you tell them and they'll change their behavior. But if you know that they're not going to change, so then the Gemara says in some context that they're better off not knowing, because if they're going to know and violate anyway, so they're better off when they didn't know, they were a shogeg, they were inadvertent sinners. So that's normally the rule. So why would it be that here it's different, apparently from the story? That why is the Chafetz Chaim saying that better you should read this book about the laws of Lashon Hara and learn all these rules that you're not going to keep? Hi?
Well, automatically, it's quite likely that you'll end up keeping some of these laws.
I think that's a part of it, right?
You study the laws and you'll care more about them and you'll try not to.
So that's probably true, that maybe he didn't really think the guy would be able to maintain his lack of observance after he was exposed to all of it. But if we take it at its meaning, that he really said, even if you don't keep the rules, it's still worthwhile. So why is that true? Yeah,
well, it's because that idea of being sighing and saying, thinking for a second about what I could be, that could inspire, that alone could inspire someone to begin to think in realms he never did about how he could become a better person. And he opened with it.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of truth to that. And basically, this is essentially a comment to the Rambam. That the Rambam has a comment in his introduction to Pirkei Avos. If you're familiar with that introduction, he has an introduction that is 8 chapters long and therefore has a very creative title, the Shmona Prakim. So in the Shmona Prakim, in the 6th parak of the Shmona Prakim, so the Rambam discusses a medrash you might be familiar with, the Yalkut Shemoni. That the medrash says that there's no need for a person to claim that he has no interest in non-kosher food. Go back to that example. Right, that when you walk past the sign from McDonald's and you see 2 burgers, fries, and a Coke in a free apartment, 69 cents. So there's no mitzvah for you to say, oh, that doesn't interest me at all. That's so disgusting. Who would ever want such a thing? So as the medrash is perfectly legitimate and appropriate for a person to say, that's very attractive. I would certainly be interested in that cheeseburger. But God told me not to, so I'm going to abstain. But if you live 120 years and you never lose your interest in the cheeseburger, that's fine. As long as you recognize that it's prohibited to you, and that's enough. So says the Rambam. In Shmona Prakim, the Rambam says that that's not true about everything. That it depends what area of halacha you're talking about. So for example, if a person had the attitude, you know, I really wish I could just kill people all day. That would be what I would want to do most, to just kill people from morning till night. But the Torah tells me not to, so I won't. Such a guy would have a very hard time finding a roommate. Right? That's definitely not the desired attitude of the Torah. So the Rambam essentially says that when the Medrash tells you you don't have to ever lose your interest in cheeseburgers or whatever, so that means that when we're talking about what we call the chukim, the halachos that we don't really understand what they're about. They are above rationality. So then, it's okay to say, listen, I don't understand the value system behind kashrus or shadnas or whatever it is. So I can't say I'm really repulsed by it. It doesn't disgust me. But I'll stay away. That's fine. But when it comes to the mitzvos that we theoretically could understand, that we do have some intellectual access to, so then it takes on a whole different element to it. And then we do want that we will mold our personalities to this value system. Now, that may not be natural. It may be that a person might want to kill people, to steal, etc., etc. It doesn't mean you start off that way. But through a course of a lifetime, the exposure to these ideals should have an impact on your personality, and it should be such that ultimately you are repulsed by these types of violations. So the Rambam essentially puts down this principle that we do desire that your personality would be affected by these concepts. So therefore, it's practical to say that maybe when it comes to learning these ideals, there's a difference between learning the halachas that we hope that we can comprehend, that we have some type of access to the rationality behind them, and that's a whole different element, a whole different aspect than what we find in the chukim, in the areas where we have less rational access. And that the very study, in addition to the value of Talmud Torah that we find by everything, but that the study itself is going to have an impact on the personality that is on a whole different level. And therefore, perhaps, this is what the Chafetz Chaim is saying, that yes, normally we have a rule, mutav shiur shogin. But if you're not going to observe the halacha, better off you shouldn't know about it. But when it comes to the areas like Lashon Hara, which in a way, by the way, Lashon Hara could be the quintessential Jewish ideal, because it's both, on the one hand, understandable and rational. It's a principle that you don't have to be Jewish to relate to. But on the other hand, by prohibiting speaking true things about people, it takes things to a whole different level. It takes this idea that you can relate to even if you're not Jewish, but puts it on a different plane and tells us how we can really understand these ideas in a whole different way. So this is particularly representative of how engaging in this kind of study can have an impact on the personality that's very different. So I think, specifically, Joseph, your question you said before, that I think there's a lot of both going on. That on the one hand, we need to have these absolute principles because they reflect the eternal truths that are mandatory to us. But at the same time, we are very much commanded to look at these ideals and to try to understand them even more than other areas of halacha. And Rabbeinu Yonah has a comment in his commentary to Pirkei Avos. In the beginning of Pirkei Avos, the first Mishnah says, having mesunim bedin, which we normally translate to mean, you should ponder, you should be very careful and deliberate in matters of judgment and justice. And Rabbeinu Yonah has a comment, reading a little bit differently, that if you want to understand God, so to speak, having mesunim bedin, you should think carefully about the principles of justice that we find in the Torah, because they teach us how to understand God's ways of justice, how to understand the core principles of justice and righteousness in the world. And then, yes, we are very much then told to take that to the next step, as you suggested. So that was the Netziv in his commentary to Chumash. And Netziv says we have a concept in general in the Torah of Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra. We're not allowed to take away from the Torah. We're not allowed to add on. If somebody thinks that on Sukkot, he'll be better if he has five species in his Luv and Esrog. That would be nicer, so we're told you're not allowed to do that. Bal Tosif, you can't add on to the Torah. So the Netziv says that it's clear to him that that applies only in the realm of the chukim and the mitzvos that we don't really understand. So the Torah tells us the rules, we can't do more, we can't do less. But when it comes to the ben adam lechaveres, when it comes to the mishpatim that we're able to understand, so the Netziv says there's no prohibition of Bal Tosif. A person wants to go further, a person wants to go above and beyond, so then that is very much compatible with what we're talking about here. So we do find in this area of halacha that there is a particular value that even transcends the normal Talmud Torah value to try to understand what it is we're talking about, which again is why it's a particular thrill this year that those of you are learning Bav Metzia in the morning. So it's really an opportunity, Bav Metzia even more than other Masechtas, it's really an opportunity to have a very direct insight into the principles of the Torah and the principles of Chazal in how people are supposed to treat each other and to really work at trying to understand what these underlying ideas are. Joseph, you had a question?
Sort of just for us, like, whatever conceptual. Do you think saying that the idea of Lashon Hara, whatever, gossip, mongering, whatever you want to call it, is very understandable by, you know, a secularized lifestyle, that it sort of degrades the concept of Lashon Hara?
No.
Saying, even to them, it's so basic, so how can you say it's so holy to us?
No, not at all, because the thing that it's really a combination of all, that it starts off from principles that you can relate to. It's not completely abstract and ritualized and something out of the realm of understanding. But in practice, it is so much more refined and so much more detailed and elevated than what you find anywhere else in society that it's able to serve as perhaps the best example. Yeah, I do, but I think that that's it really...
It's
the opposite. No offense. But so this is one difference that we find when it comes to interpersonal law and monetary law, that the study has an additional value, which I'll also say, you know, is very much, again, if you're learning about Messiah, you have this opportunity a lot in the morning. But that'll also be part of what we try to do over the course of this semester, is that we definitely want to know details and rules that's going to impact our lives in the business world. And the business world applies to all of us, whether you're going into business professionally or you're just living life. We all have interactions with business, so it's applicable to all of us equally. But as we talk about these themes, I definitely want to try to call attention to what the underlying principles are that we should not only know the rules and the basics and the bottom line, but understand somewhat of a conceptual idea of what it is that's being conveyed. So on the one hand, when we have this whole realm, we have an extra focus on theory, more so than the rest of the Torah, an extra focus on concept and understanding, even separate from practice. But the fascinating thing is you actually find the opposite also, that there's more of a focus on practice than there is on the concept in some ways. That there is an idea that a lot of the poskim endorse. It starts off you in the Haftorah for Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah in the Haftorah. So you read the story of the birth of Shmuel. So Shmuel's mother, Chana, she didn't have any kids, and she was very distraught, and she used to daven very hard that she should have children. And her husband was married to another woman, to Penina, who had many children. And Penina used to taunt Chana for not having children. That's unbelievable, right? That's the cruelest thing you can imagine. How could that be that somebody could do such a thing? And yet, the Gemara, in the end of the first parak of Bava Basra, the Gemara says that Penina l'shem shamayim nisgavna. Penina meant well. She thought that, right, if she drove her so crazy, she'd daven harder and it would work out for her. So that's an unbelievable thing. The Gemara is going to say that this was okay. You're going to defend Penina as such an act of cruelty. We're being told that that's okay. So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, I'm sure it's a familiar name, was the great Mirror Rosh Yeshiva and Mashgiach, the author of the Sichos Musar, a classic sefer you should definitely get a hold of. So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz explained, as many others understood also, that the Gemara is not defending her at all. We know that she's punished terribly, from the Nach. She's punished terribly. She's not to be defended. The Gemara is making the opposite point. The Gemara is saying that it doesn't matter that she meant well. That when you're dealing in the interpersonal realm, we have a tremendous focus on results. When it comes to you and God, so God has a commandment for you to put on tefillin, to take a lulav, whatever it is. So we have a concept, onus rachmana patre, which means that you try and you can't. You're on a desert island, you don't have tefillin, you don't have a lulav and esrog, whatever it is. So God knows that you tried, okay, and God can credit your intent. But when it comes to dealing with people, there is no such concept. That the thought doesn't count as much as you think it does, because people need results. If somebody, a poor person, comes to your door and he's starving, he's about to collapse, and he needs some tzedakah, and you say, "Sorry, I'm busy right now. I'm mostly the mitzvah. I'm in the middle of taking a lulav. I don't have to worry about you." So he's not going to say, "Well, all right, he's mostly the mitzvah. Therefore, I credit him as if he wanted to give me tzedakah." The guy's going to collapse anyway. A human being who has actual physical needs. Those needs have to really be addressed. And if you're going to hurt somebody, you're going to hurt somebody's feelings. The fact that you meant well is not going to make them any better. As Reb Chaim Shmulevitz put it, he said, you put your hand in an oven and you mean well. When you take it out, it's still burnt. It's still going to have the same impact. Your good intentions are not going to save you. So there is the opposite of what we just said, that there's also a greater focus on practice. You have to actually get it right. When it comes to the area of Bin Adam Makom, good faith effort, you do the best you can, you can't be in two places at once, so that's understandable. God can credit you with everything you try to do. But when you're dealing with human beings, it doesn't work. You have to actually have results. So it's two opposite sides of the coin. There's a greater focus on theory because we have to understand the theory, we have to relate to it, and there's also a greater emphasis on the result, that we have to actually get the act done or not do the bad act because human beings are actually going to be hurt. And it's fascinating, there is a discussion that a lot of the principles that were other areas of halacha where we have excuses, like we just mentioned before, a person is osek a mitzvah, you're involved in one mitzvah so you can't be expected to be somewhere else, or any other type of excuse you could invoke. So very often you have acceptable excuses in halacha. So sometimes the poskim will say they don't work in the interpersonal realm. That so the example we just mentioned, osik mitzvah patim and mitzvah, there are many poskim who say that the fact you're involved in a mitzvah doesn't help. You should stop that. You should take care of a starving person because they're not going to be taken care of otherwise. Like Avram Avinu. Right? Avram Avinu is being visited by God in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, and he sees what he thinks are human beings. It turns out they're angels. But he sees people who need to be fed, who need to be attended to. So he says, God can wait. God's going to let me interrupt to deal with human beings because there is this actual need that they be taken care of. Abraham, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, what's the makor for that psak?
Which one?
By interpersonal relationships that you don't say all the words. Like in the Gemara,
yes,
that's
okay.
See us, that's like the makor for the makor, because you have a Yosef is regarding that there is an ani.
You're talking about the Shomer Sacher.
Yeah.
Right, so that's an interesting discussion in general. The Gemara does seem to apply the exemption of Osa Mitzvah Patam and HaMitzvah to a Shomer Aveda. A person who's watching lost property is going to be exempt from Staka according to that Gemara.
Right.
So the question is that in that context, the person's involved in another interpersonal mitzvah. Because Shomer Aveda is also a mitzvah ben Adam l'chaveiro. So it's a good question whether or not you can extrapolate from there to a ben adam l'makom, but it's possible for mitzvah you're involved in. There is significant literature that these excuses, so to speak, I'm just using the word excuse because it helps to illustrate what we're talking about, maybe don't apply, say, dochalosa says to mitzvah, maybe don't apply in the area of ben adam l'chaveiro. Chaz, you want to comment on that?
Right, yeah, even by Perugia Rabbi Yosef specifically, and I emphasize that point. I think most of the Rishonim there explained that it's not when you're involved in the...
You're involved in the taking care of... of another interpersonal mitzvah.
As opposed to just having it doesn't necessarily count. As you have to really be an interpersonal relationship with somebody else and doing that.
Correct, right. So that's also the element of active versus passive, but it does address that element as well. So, hi, Ilan.
And going back to the point that you made about the intention of the mitzvah,
mm-hmm.
we see, though, in regards to Emmet, that for Shalom Bayit and similar instances, it's irrelevant of your intention is what's important, even though you are
correct, because also, again, you're dealing with the impact on human beings, and that's it shoots right to the impact, that's part of the issue, right? Is that because
so the impact is the only significance.
Well, but it's the dual significance, so it seems to me that it's pretty clear that you have a focus on both. You have to get both the theory and the impact. There's a difficult Orach Chaim. The Orach Chaim says in the end of Bereishis and Vayechi, which we read a few weeks ago, that when Yosef meets with his brothers, and the brothers eventually realize that they kind of messed up, and they apologize to him, so he says to them, don't worry, God has good plans, you tried to hurt me, but God had different plans, it worked out well. So there's a difficult Arachayim. The Arachayim there says, yeah, everything worked out. It's like somebody tries to poison his friend, and it turns out that instead of poison, he gave him Diet Pepsi, so you see everything worked out in the end. So what's he trying to say? It's okay to do attempted murder as long as it's not actual murder? So some commentaries want to say that, oh yeah, this is the same principle, that when you're dealing with human beings, it's the impact that counts. So as long as you don't actually end up hurting him, so then that's all that matters. But that's only half the equation. You know, we still see the other half of the equation. You have to, because you understand the theory, it has a greater impact on you. So to engage in trying to kill your friend, even if you're not successful, certainly wouldn't think that that's not a problem. So really you find both. You have to figure out what the Rachayim means, but the fact is we have both. We have a tremendous impact on trying to make sure that you do the right thing at the end of the day, and that you relate to the theory behind it. Those are equally important, which is why we're going to try to devote time to both, and in terms of the various halachas that we're talking about, to make sure that we get the details right, but also to make sure that we understand some of the theory behind it. And it's fascinating, this idea that excuses, so to speak, don't seem to apply. You even find a discussion that some have that even the principle of pikuach nefesh docha akol, that you can do almost any transgression to save your life, maybe that doesn't apply to ben adam l'chaveros, which is a fascinating idea, very hard to swallow. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says he doesn't think that's even a possibility. Anyone who says that is wrong. But there is some basis in the Gemara to discuss that. The Gemara has a discussion about the Kama, about whether or not it's permissible to save your life at the expense of somebody else's property. Can you steal somebody's property to save your life? Which, again, in a practical halacha, it's very hard to see how that could even be a question. We know that we normally take the attitude that you can do everything except for the big three to save your life. So what might be at play here is that there's still a fundamental difference, that yes, you can steal to save your life, but that's not the same thing as violating Shabbos to save your life. If you're mechal Shabbos to save your life, or you eat non-kosher food to save your life, okay, so then that was completely permissible. That's what God said, that you're allowed to eat treif, you're allowed to be mechal Shabbos, you can eat on Yom Kippur or whatever to save your life, there's no transgression at all. But when it comes to stealing, so the person who's being robbed, he doesn't necessarily allow you to rob him. So you're right that it's less of a prohibition to steal than to die, or you know, you have to, the obligation to protect your life will still outweigh the prohibition against stealing, but it would still be an act of stealing, perhaps. And maybe there would be an obligation to pay back what you stole. Or it's conceptually different, that there was an act of stealing, it just was necessary in order to save your life. And the difference in theory also has relevance, and that's also perhaps a reflection of this idea that there is a whole different impact when we're talking about interpersonal law than there is when we're talking about the mitzvahs ben adam l'malchut. Hi.
Yeah, in that example, wouldn't he have some sort of help save you?
So that's also part of the discussion. That's why it's a question in the Gemara what exactly we mean. We say and the question of when you have to, it may also depend on how necessary that particular act was. Were there other choices of extensive literature about it, but it all could point to this idea that maybe even if we say yes, at the end of the day you do have to steal to save your life, but there's still a difference between that and Shabbos and Kashrus and the like, where it's just between you and God and he says it's okay. Here the victim is not necessarily going to say it's okay, so, or even if he does, there's still something that happened and that has to be addressed independently. Hi.
There could be a case where the guy's not kind to save your life, but
yes, it could definitely come up with such cases. So that's why it's a little bit more of a complex discussion. Joseph?
Is stealing like the nafkamina between the hakira, whether certain isurim were always in place with the exception of certain, let's say, Rosh Hashanah and Shabbos type of thing, right? So where I can say...
Do you mind read the chuyah?
Yeah, well, yeah, like the ikar v'yishpah we didn't call makadom ha'torah type of thing, where we might say that the isur never applied in such an instance.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated. It gets a little complicated. It gets a little bit far afield. But basically, it's just the point that we need to know for this point is that here God has the ability to totally waive the issue, either to say it never was there or that it's not there now. While when it comes to an interpersonal offense, even if it has to be done, it's still an offense. The person is still suffering, and therefore there's still a consequence. So we try to do what we can to minimize that. So we try to get the theory right, and we try to get the impact right. So all of these are crucial elements in how we act. Now, to go back to Joseph's original point before, so Joseph said, so why don't we just have a system where we get told the ideals and we make up our own rules? So I think we can address the first half of the equation, why we have to have the rules, why the rules are there in order to convey this message. But there is a lot... Sorry?
It's a basis.
Yeah, but there is a lot to say about going then beyond. You know, it's interesting. So in a few weeks we'll read Parshas Mishpatim. So you want the Dvar Torah to talk about on Shabbos then. So the opening pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. So Rashi says in the beginning of Mishpatim, the Torah says, "Asher tossim lefnehem." This is what you shall put in front of them. So what's the language of "you shall put it in front of them"? So Rashi has a comment over there that very hard to understand comment that apparently Moshe wanted to go on a strike. It sounds like it's a labor union issue. That you would think that you could just get away with just mentioning this two or three times and not explaining it in detail. So says God, no, Moshe, you have to asher tasim lefneihem, you have to go into detail about this as well. What's going on there? Why did Moshe want a break all of a sudden? He wanted to renegotiate his contract. He wasn't going to explain this part of the Torah. So the Rashi of Karen B'Avner of Goldwicht explained that this is the same idea as we've been talking about. That when it comes to Mishpatim, so it comes to these rules of interpersonal behavior, so we have somewhat of a complex relationship. That on the one hand, so it's more understandable than the rest of the Torah. There's more that we think we can figure out on our own. So one might have the attitude, yeah, I know this stuff. I don't need to hear from the Torah because I can figure out how we should have a society. So we have to, on the one hand, we have to know that's not true, that we have rules from the Torah that are just as much mitzvahs from the Torah as the whole rest of the Torah, and we have to be taught that from Sinai. That's what the Rashi also says over there in the beginning of Mishpatim, right? That we have to ve'ela, that this is also from Sinai, this is also from the Torah just as much as the more obviously ritual and religious ideas are from the Torah. But at the same time, don't think that it stops there, that this all the more so we have to go into detail and understand and study it, because we do have the ability to apply it and to have an impact on our personality the way that's meant to be the case. So that gets us into a very significant area of halacha, and a very significant area specifically of monetary halacha. That's very much a part of any introductory discussion of how we're going to address things. That the Gemara has a concept called Lifnim Meshuras Hadin, that we are told that we have to act above and beyond the law. And it's a difficult concept to understand, just in its theory, it's hard to understand. That the Gemara derives it as what seems to be an obligation. It's derived from Pesukim, that on the one hand, Parshas Yisro, that we'll read before Mishpatim. So the Torah tells us that Yisro gives advice to Moshe, that Yisro tells Moshe that the way he has his court system, it's not very efficient, that he should have a hierarchical system where you'll have lower-level judges and mid-level judges, and they'll deal with all the day-to-day stuff. And you, Moshe, you'll be there for the hardest things. And also, you'll tell people the basic principles of life, the big ideas that they should know about how to live their lives. He says, "Vodata mesaderech yelchu ba v'asamaisa asher yasun," that you should teach them the way of life that they should live by and that which they should do. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia and in Bava Kama, the Gemara says that hamaisa asher yasun, that means the maisa, that's the din, and asher yasun, that they should do, that refers to lefnin mishuras hadin, that you should go beyond the law. So from there, you have this obligation of going beyond the law. And we also have a pasuk in Parshas Veschanan. The Torah tells us, v'yasisa hayashar v'hatov, that you should do that which is straight and that which is good. And there's an important comment that Avi had a question about that.
I was going to say, is it a chiyuv to be lefnin mishuras hadin?
So that's what we have to try to figure out. We'll have to see if
isn't that like contradictory kind of?
Ah, that's what it sounds like, right? So that's what we have to try to figure out. Brett?
Isn't there also flimsures that applies to different people differently?
Like that might be one possible approach.
So there's this basic law, and then there's depending on who you are or other.
That might be one way of looking at it. It's not the way everyone looks at it, but that might be part of it.
And then we also see with in Bava Metzia that if you're like certain cases of living with Shravatin might not be like returning a bit to a not great.
So let's talk about that. So basically, essentially, the Gemara has the idea of Maisa Asher Yasun, and also of Asisa Yasher V'Hatov. So that pasuk is a little hard to understand what exactly that pasuk means. Asisa Yasher V'Hatov. You should do that which is right and that which is good. So that's a little vague. And the Ramban has a comment over there. Right. So that's basically part of what he responds, that it seems to be both redundant and vague. And he has a comment over there, which is very parallel, very similar to his more famous comment. He has a very similar idea in Parshas Kedoshim, which is quoted much more often. In the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim, so Torah says, Kedoshim to you, you should be holy. So the Ramban asks the same question. It's both vague and redundant. So we have all the specific mitzvahs in the Torah that keep us holy. And we don't know what holy means in the abstract. What does that mean, to be holy? So there he comments that everything that the Torah has for us is essentially creating a pattern and a picture. And we have to observe all the details, but we have to also try to perceive that there is a theme, there's a pattern, that we should be holy people. So if one would follow all the details, but still find a way to be completely unrestrained and completely unrefined, Ramban says that would have been a naval bereshus haTorah, a person who is a rogue, a scoundrel, a vulgar person. We use the word nevela, nivel pet, to mean vulgarity, person who is a vulgar person, but he's technically within the letter of the law. So therefore, says the Ramban, that's what Kedoshim Tiyu comes to tell us you can't have. You can't have such a personality because the Torah also tells us, on top of everything else, be holy, see the pattern. So too, Vasisa Yashavatov, Ramban says essentially it's the other half of the equation, the same kind of idea. That we have all of these details, the Torah tells us, he lists them, the Torah tells us, don't speak Lashon Hara, and don't take revenge, and don't bear a grudge, and don't lie, and all these rules that we have, Ben Adam L'Chaveru, we have all these rules that regulate how we are supposed to behave. But theoretically, it's possible for a person to follow all of these rules and still fall into a very specific halachic category known as a jerk. You could essentially be a jerk and still, that was the other Ramban, but you could be a person who's a nasty person who found a way to follow all the loopholes so that he's following all the rules and he's not being yashar and he's not being tov, he's not being straight, he's not being good. So therefore, says the Ramban, this is meant to address that loophole, that theoretical crack that you could fall through, and to understand that you have to perceive the pattern at the same time.
Chesky. I think when Lamar used by a in a manner that's like more halachic, like that will like force
So that's part of what we have to figure out. You know, what lifnim mishuras hadin means. The Gemara has this few specific examples. We'll talk about it in a second. We'll see if we can finish this whole introduction before we run out of time. We'll have to carry over a little bit to next class. Again, we'll have to see how much we can calibrate one topic per class schedule. But the Gemara has some specific dinim which are connected with this. We'll try to talk about which emerge from this. So basically, the Ramban, on the one hand, tells us that this is the ideal, that we have to, this is a requirement essentially, that we have to be able to see the pattern beyond the details. So it's crucial that we observe the details, but we can't let the details be the whole story. And if we fall between the cracks, then that is a violation of the Torah. That's not Yashar and Tov. And in that context, he also invokes this concept of Lifnim Mishuras Hadin. So Lifnim Mishuras Hadin is a difficult idea conceptually to understand, as some have asked already, that it sounds like a contradiction in terms. That the very phrase means go beyond the law, go beyond the details of the law. And yet, if that's desirable, so then the question becomes, so what do we need the law for? So if there is some point beyond the law that is desirable, so then why don't we just put the law there? Why don't we just recalibrate the law differently? And especially if, according to those, it's a machlokas harishonim, that there are rishonim who maintain that we assume that to go beyond the letter of the law is an obligation. So that really sounds like a contradiction in terms. And in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah quotes Machlokas Rishonim, the Mordechai was of the opinion that Beis Din can enforce going beyond the letter of the law. And the other Rishonim, the Rush quotes the Ben Yeruchim, other Rishonim say, how does that make sense? It's a logical impossibility that if the Beis Din can enforce going beyond the law, then that is the law. What does it mean to go beyond the law and have that be an obligation, have that be an enforceable obligation, especially? Sounds very much like a contradiction in terms. Joseph?
They can say it's a moral obligation without drawing a line. They can say they're saying we can't tell you have to feel bad, but it's between you and Hashem, you are supposed to feel bad.
Right, so but the Lifnimishur Sadin never means feeling bad. That's also something that we have to connect to. That's a whole different discussion.
But it's
relevant because the Lifnimishur Sadin.
To help when you, whatever it is.
But it's going to mean doing something, and then why doing something is both optional and obligatory, is a little bit difficult. So a couple of hands up. I think it was first Yonatan, then Avi, then Brett.
Is it similar to the same question about Midas Tom?
Midas Tom is also a complicated question because we'll have to get into what Midas Tom means. But there, the Gemara says, Kofin, that we enforce Midas Tom. So it's got some overlap, but there, that's more baseline, and this is more the other direction. That Midas Tom represents going in an area where to not do something is representative of real cruelty, so to speak. And here we're talking about going beyond the letter of the law. What does it mean to, what does that mean practically? And how can it be both an obligation and extra credit, so to speak, at the same time? So there are a couple of approaches that one could take to this. Just to illustrate the point a little bit, it's relevant to what Chesky was talking about, that it's not just a general ideal. There are some specific examples the Gemara gives when we invoke this Liftim Mishara Sadin, and understanding the examples is going to be relevant. For example, they're both Bav Mitzvah topics. Again, this is just a very, very rich Masechta, but later on, at the end of Bav Mitzvah, the Gemara talks about a concept called Bar Metzra, that there is an idea that if you're selling land, so strictly speaking, you have a buyer and a seller. So they could agree on whatever they agree with. I could sell property to whoever I want to sell it to, and we make a deal between ourselves. That's the deal. So I could sell it to whoever I want. It's my land to sell. If I'm selling it, I could sell it to whoever wants to buy it. But the Gemara says that there is a concept that if a person owns land that's adjacent to the land that I'm selling, so I have to give him first dibs. That's called bar metzra, a person who already has land that connects to this land, it's going to be more valuable to that person than it is to anyone else, because he can maximize the combining of the land, and he's going to have a much harder time if he needs to buy some extra land, and now he's going to have to buy land that's further away, it's not connected, it's not contiguous with his land, it's going to be much less valuable and much more difficult for him. Question about that?
Can you just say that that's an extension of
so the Gemara.
So the Gemara
puts it in Vayashav HaTov specifically, that it's beyond the legal requirement, that strictly speaking, I'm selling land, I could sell it to whoever I want. But because of Yasisa Yashav HaTov, you should sell it specifically to a person who, you should give first chance to, for right of first refusal to a person who has this issue. So that's one case where the Gemara brings it up as what sounds like an obligation. And another context, if you learn the second parak of Metziah this year, so you might be a little bit shocked in some of the rules that you find in terms of Hashavas Aveda. We have this basic obligation, this core value of returning lost property, and then you find that there are a lot of cases where you're not obligated to return the property. And one of the most difficult concepts to understand, that's a little easier to understand, but that's relevant also. It comes up in this conversation also. But just to give an example, one of the harder concepts to understand, there isn't, but it's also good because this also is a stand-in for a lot of issues, and I don't think we're going to devote a session to Hashavas Aveda, so just to talk about this for a minute is helpful. There's a concept called Yeish, that if the person has given up hope of getting his property back, he figures it's for falling already, either that has happened, or you have scenarios where that can be assumed to happen, where just the average person will have such a reaction. So strictly speaking, you're not obligated to return the property anymore, which is a little bit surprising if you had never heard of that halacha before, and doesn't seem right to us. It seems that if a person has shown up and you know that it's his property, he just happens to have given up hope, and you have his wallet, and you know that he'd really like to get it back, and you know that it's his, so you would think morally that it would be right to give it back to him. So this idea that I'm not obligated to is a little hard to swallow. And indeed, the Gemara says that that's the case, that it's preferable that really, if the scenario comes up that you can give it back, that you should give it back. And it sounds also like that's an obligation. The Gemara says that's lefnim b'shuras ha-din, that the din is you don't have to return it, but lefnim b'shuras ha-din you should. And we find in Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, in the Shach, everybody afterwards says that the minig is that you do give it back, and again they say maybe the Bezdin will force you to give it back, that it's not only the moral thing to do, but it's essentially obligatory. So again, this is a little bit confusing. So then why don't we just put the law there? Why don't we just say that that's the requirement? Why do we say, okay, this is one thing, but we really encourage you to do something else, and maybe we're going to actually even force you to do something else? So that's all a difficult idea to understand. And then we find other statements, and the Gemara has a fascinating discussion which is very relevant to trying to understand what we're talking about. The Gemara, in the end of the fifth parak of Bav Metziah, the sixth parak rather, the Daf Pei Gimel, so the Gemara has a story of Rabbi Barachana, or the Barachuna, different Kirsos, who's talking about, but this is a very fascinating idea to try to understand. Gemara tells a story. We're really going to have to end up continuing this a little bit on next Wednesday. So again, we'll have to figure out how to calibrate the different discussions. But essentially, the Gemara talks about, this is really one of the core texts in understanding Jewish monetary law. And the Gemara says that Rabbi Baruch Hanna, whoever it was, different Gersos a little bit, what his name was, but that he had workers who were working for him, and they broke his stuff. They dropped the barrel, whatever it was, they damaged his property in a way that caused him a tremendous loss. So, strictly speaking, they owe him money. They broke his stuff in a way that was negligent. It sounds, Rashi says they were negligent, they were poshe. So they're guilty, they have to pay him for his stuff. Sorry. And so he had confiscated their clothing, he had property of theirs that he wanted to hold on to in payment for the stuff that they broke. And they complained. They said they need their clothes, they need their stuff. So they went to Rav, and they asked for a ruling. And Rav said he's got to give it back. So he was surprised, because he felt he was entitled to this confiscated property, because they broke his stuff. They owe him a lot of money. So he said to Rav, he said, Dina hachi, that's really the law, that's really the rule? And Rav said, yeah, for you it is. And he quotes a pasuk, a different pasuk actually, which is the subject of the discussion, and Tosfos gets involved in it. Says Laman Telech B'Derech Tovim, that you should travel the good path. This is what you should do. And not only is what you should do, but I'm giving you a ruling. That's the halacha. That's what you have to do as your personal obligation. So he's okay, he's surprised. But then these workers, they had more chutzpah than that. They said, not only do we want our stuff back, but you owe us for a day's work. We don't want to go home starving, so you have to pay us for all the work we did for you. So he thought, that's a little bit much. It can't be that not only does he have to give them back their stuff, but he has to even pay them for what they did that day. So he goes back to Rav, and they go back to Rav, and Rav says, you got to pay them. Says, what? I got to pay? You know, how could that be? Dina hachi, that's the law. That's really the rule. So he responds back to him, yeah, for you, that's the rule of Yorcha Tzadikim Tishmo. That you should protect, you should guard the paths of Tzadikim. That's what you got to do. So here again, this is a fascinating application that apparently the rule is pitched in one place. And here he's told that not only should he go beyond and above, but that's, in a sense, obligatory for him. So we have to figure out, and maybe we'll have to push us off a little bit to next week, how exactly do we balance these obligations? And this is very much a core of how we relate to a lot of these ideals. That on the one hand, when it comes to Hashavas Aveda, when it comes to the laws of merchandise and who I'm going to sell to, or when it comes to these disputes between people, so on the one hand, there's a certain objective rule, but on the other hand, we're being clearly conveyed that there is more to aspire to, and that perhaps we would even tell you it's an obligation, and perhaps a court would even enforce such an obligation. So how could it be then that that's not simply the law? What's the point in having two systems? So some of you so far have suggested a little bit the beginnings of a approach, but there's more to say about it, and there's more to understand about how that comes together. So that'll be our cliffhanger, God willing. Wednesday we'll pick up on that, but separate from trying to suggest the resolutions, which again we'll give a little more attention to. Is there any questions about anything that we spoke about so far? So just to recap, you know, essentially we spoke a little bit about the importance of honesty in business, about the recognition of the central role that plays in Jewish law, about the fact that we believe there's an objective truth that we want to have only what's our property and not any stolen property. We talked a little bit about what the Gemara says about tzaddikim wouldn't want to have anyone else's property, but also don't want to be casual about their own property. We talked about the Baal HaTanya and his idea that there is heresy involved in sinning, and we thought specifically in the realm of monetary law. And then we talked a little bit about how the study of this ideal has a greater impact than even other areas of halacha. We told the story about the Chafetz Chaim, Rishol Salanter, and the Rambam, the whole idea. We talked about how, since we're able to understand to some extent what these ideas are about, therefore, above and beyond the value that's always there for Torah study, specifically in this context, there's even more to possibly investigate and to learn from. And then we talked about the other side of the equation, how in practice also there is a greater focus, and all the different outgrowths of that idea that we have to make sure we don't inadvertently hurt people or fail to help when necessary, even beyond any other excuses that would be acceptable in areas of halacha that are more between man and God. And then we talked a little bit about this question of liftim b'shuras adin and the derivations from the psukim, and how it seems to be that we have this apparent contradiction between, on the one hand, the letter of the law, and on the other hand, a clearly conveyed message that we need to go beyond, and that maybe that's an obligation, maybe even enforceable, and that we'll have to pick up from that, God willing, next week. Do we have a minion that will stay behind for Meir? Any takers? Raise your hand. No? Doesn't look like it. All right. Is there none? Skype somebody in. All right. Everyone who can't stay for Meir should leave now.
I'll see you in the hall.
I see who's left. Okay. Have a great day.
What about the time? Oh. Yo, recorder.
Hey, Mishki.
He got one of those also?
I don't know. It's really cheap. Like, it feels like plastic.
I know, because I have one for Sam, but apparently this is like the best one out there now.
Really? Yeah. I figured he paid like literally $5 for this thing. All right.